Hey there, Pastor Mark here. It's our prayer that this message would encourage and equip you in your relationship with Jesus. We're able to provide this content due to the joyful generosity of our financial partners. And if you'd be willing to join that tribe and help get some sermons like this around the world, you can donate at harvestbaptist.info/give. God bless. Let me find out, where are all of my readers at? Anyone in the room who you love to read? Can we get a show of hands? All of my readers, I'm going to scan along here. All right, there's a lot of you. I'm going to join in with you and raise my hand as well. As a kid, I was a reader. As a young man, I was a reader. I'm not sure if I'm still in the young man stage or not, but even now, love to read. I can remember as a kid, I did not know when the new video game release date was. I could not have told you. But if you wanted to know when the new R.L. Stine Goosebumps book was coming out, I was your man. Like, I knew where to be. I was going to be in line. There wasn't a line, but I knew where to go at Walgreens and what day it was released. And for those of you that are judging me for reading Goosebumps, you know, I don't get over it. I'm fine. A demon never possessed me or anything. It was all right. But I love to read, and my love for reading really came from my mom. My mom is a voracious reader. Still to this day, if you ask mom for Mother's Day or for Christmas, what do you want? You're probably going to get a book list. She's just going to tell you, here's 10 books, you know, pick a few of them and send them to me or something. And I can remember almost every week of our life, we went to the library. We'd go to the library and we would bring like a duffel bag, like a huge bag, and we would load it up with books, and we probably supported the library with all of our late fees as the years went on, but we read a lot. And even in our family now, Maggie and I, we like to read. One of the things that attracted me to my wife was that she loved to read, and we would exchange books, favorite books, early on in our dating life. And I remember reading some of those to try to find out more about her. You know, what books does she like, and what does it say about her? And even to this day, we try to instill a passion for reading in our kids. We will incentivize them to read books and give them, even part of their chore list would be to read X amount of pages. And when we have time without kids, we like to read. We'll take some time and we'll be on the beach or on a bike ride or on a hike, and oftentimes Maggie will take out her AirPods, and she takes out hers because I always lose mine, to be clear, but she gives me one and then she puts one in her ear, and we'll turn on a novel or something. We'll listen to it as we go along because we just enjoy reading. And I say all that to say, I reread a book this last week that I've really come to enjoy. Not that I enjoy every point that the book makes. I disagree with a few of them. But the main point, the salient point, I can really go along with. And it's the book called Tribe by Sebastian Younger. And Younger was a war correspondent who spent his time in a lot of carnage, a lot of battles, but began to notice something that was curious to him. And that was, there were soldiers who, when they went home, they missed war. And he began to ask himself, why? Why do they do this? Is it because they're a glutton for violence? Is it because they're adrenaline junkies and all of the hypervigilance that comes with war and the adrenaline that comes alongside of it, that they just missed that? They found out that really wasn't the reason. The reason was they missed the sense of community and camaraderie that they had with their fellow soldiers in the middle of war. It tended to erase all of their differences and put them on the same page and really create a brotherhood or a sisterhood or a family there on the battlefield. And they missed that. And he spins his book really as a critique of our individualistic Western society and how we could get back to the idea of tribes, which is an idea that I can go along with and can even support and will tell you often that we need community inside of the church in an age of loneliness. However, there is a dark side to community if you're not careful, maybe even a dark twin that we would call tribalism. And there's a big difference between being part of a tribe, a close-knit group of people who somehow are bound by shared values or purpose or mutual care, and all that can go alongside of a tribe, belonging and growth and mutual support. But there's a big difference between that and tribalism. Tribalism is an us versus them mentality. Tribalism is where loyalty to the group grows so cancerous that you tend to be very suspicious, hostile, even very exclusive to those who are on the outside. Tribalism tends to demonize other people. Tribalism tends to hinder collaboration and reconciliation. Tribalism tends to foster pride and fear instead of humility and hospitality. And if you pay any attention to our culture, you see tribalism all over the place. You certainly see this in our politics nowadays, that gone are the days of the moderate middle and bipartisan voting, that the political arena is so tribal at this point that you really almost have to choose your side and make the other side your absolute enemy. You see this in our voting and as well as our political ads that are run. I can remember not all that long ago that the ad campaigns were majority, here's what candidate A is for. They will bring jobs, they will lower your taxes, and then candidate A says, I approve of this message at the end, right? And then there was this sprinkling every so often of attack ads where candidate B, they kick their dog when they come home. You should not vote for them. I'm candidate A, I approve of this message. You know what I'm talking about? And we know that's been flipped completely on its head. Now the political messaging is almost exclusively, it seems, here's what I'm against, here's how we should be against them, here's why they're a bad idea, they are what's wrong with this country, so vote for me instead. That's a change to a more tribalistic way of doing our politics. You can see tribalism at the heart of what we now know as cancel culture. That if you would disagree with me, not only does it offend me, and not only am I against you, but I'm going to make it my mission to destroy you. I came across a podcast a couple years ago on J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter novels. And fair warning, if you ever want to find it, it's not suitable for children, some of the language and such that's inside of it. But it talks about how J.K. was a feminist icon and a hero of the political left, until she disagreed with the transgender movement. And the feminist that she was, she believed that it was inherently dangerous to just allow a man to say, I'm a woman, and therefore have access to women's sports or the halfway house for women or the women's prison system or the women's bathroom or whatever it was. That was dangerous for women, and she could not get behind that idea. And it tells the story of basically these witch trials and those who used to be her fan base taking every gun in their cultural arsenal and pointing at her and emptying the chambers and just absolutely trying to destroy her. What is that? That's the cancel culture that we live in oftentimes. We certainly see tribalism in our families in ways that at least I had not seen it previously, that perhaps cancel culture has become so normative that to us, families are now running plays from the cancel culture playbook. It almost seems like gone are the days where we're having dinner at grandma's house on Sunday afternoon, period. It doesn't matter if your sister-in-law offended you this week. It doesn't matter if grandpa says some things that you think are out of touch or make you roll your eyes or are offensive. We're gonna get together and we're gonna be a family because blood is thicker than water and we're gonna do our best to put that to the side. That seems to be the exception, not the rule any longer. I am ever amazed at the parents and children who are put in situations where they now have to choose sides. I'm not coming to Christmas if they're coming to Christmas, so you can choose who you want to invite, sort of stuff. That's tribalism at a familial level. We certainly see this even in generations at times, where many times, even in churches, older and younger generations are very suspicious or dismissive of each other. That instead of looking at each other through a gospel filter and saying, you know what, you're not like me, so I could maybe learn something from you. Instead, generations look at each other and say, you're not like me, so I can't learn from you. You're too out of touch, or you're softening what I fought to establish, or whatever the case may be. And this is not even to mention the racial tribalism or the socioeconomic tribalism or the theological and denominational tribalism that's inside of the church world. This is all over the place if you pay attention. And the bottom line of all of these is that tribalism in every form tends to build walls. It tends to exclude groups of people, view everyone outside of the walls as the enemy. It very quickly takes people inside of the walls and throws them outside of the wall and calls them the enemy as well. And my argument this morning is that the church should be a place where we don't really build walls, but we build bridges. The church should be a place that is informed by the gospel and perhaps be a sharp critique to the culture around us. And instead of being a place that is tribalistic, be a place that is collaborative. And I want to talk this morning about how the church should be for collaboration in an age of tribalism. Now, I must confess that collaboration is probably not the best word. I tried to find a word that fit kind of three core ideas that I want to lay out this morning, and that was the best one that I could come up with. But the three core ideas are relationship, teamwork, and hospitality. That in an age of tribalism, there should be relationship, teamwork, and hospitality that possesses the church. Let's begin with relationship. We as the church, the people of God that come together in this place this morning, we are not mere attenders, but we actually are a family that is bound together by Jesus. You take this morning between the first service and this service, that there's probably 800 some odd people that will sit in this room, and you put that many people together, and guess what you have? You have differences. All sorts of differences. You have gender differences. You have family of origin differences. We have nationality differences. The majority of us would have an American citizenship, but there's going to be sprinkled through the room this morning, those that do not. You're going to have personality differences. You're going to have preferential differences and differences in taste and in music taste and in dress taste. You're going to have differences in political affiliations. You're going to have all of these differences. However, no matter the difference, if the people that come together in the church know, love, and worship Jesus, that should be a common denominator enough to where those differences are not erased, but those differences are so turned down, the volume goes so low that they do not become primary, and the church is able to be unified in Jesus and is able to take those differences and either put them to the side or at times accentuate them and learn from each other, but the differences don't divide the church. The church is not meant to be a segregated, factionalized place where all of these lines and all of these affiliations that would possess those that are within the culture, they don't bleed over into the church. We all love and know Jesus, and that is common ground enough for us to be on the same page and pulling in the same direction. And you see in the church in the early days that it was radical, absolutely radical, that you could take this eclectic bunch of people and put them together in a cohesive whole in ways that it had never been done before. You find the tacit admission of this in verses like Colossians, where there's neither Greek nor Jew, circumcision or uncircumcision, barbarian, Scythian, bond, free, but Christ is all and in all. Now, what is he addressing here? Paul is addressing that the culture tended to factionalize on different levels, but the church was not doing that. He says it's not about race, Greek or Jew. It's not about religious upbringing, circumcision and uncircumcision. It's not about who you are, where you're from. He mentions the barbarians, which were these brutish, crazy party animals. He mentions the Scythians, who were the backwoods, uncultured rednecks. He mentions bond or free. It's not social status. He says all of these people are coming together inside of the church because it's not about any of that. It's about Jesus. When he says this, I'll modernize it for you. It's like him saying, it's not black and white. It's not I grew up in church versus I didn't grow up in church. It's not, well, they're just a party animal. They are a redneck, or if you only knew what they did. It's not uneducated versus educated. It's not rich versus poor, or Republican versus Democrat. It's not any of that. It's Christ. Christ is in all. Christ is in all of us. That's what he's saying. And he's saying that this erases so many distinctions. It's a beautiful thing when you have a church like this, and we are a very eclectic bunch of people, and you have people in groups together and on teams together and serving together and taking mission trips together and praying with and for each other who are very different. You should have that in a church. You should have the guy who spent most of his life painting the town red and regrets a lot of his frat boy behavior sitting next to the guy who never did any of that, wouldn't know what a night in jail looked like, and would cry if he got a speeding ticket. You should have that. You should have the gal who dropped out of school sitting next to the gal who is a doctor. You should have the guy who voted for Obama next to the guy who's voting for Trump. You should have the couple who they like to hunt together and their idea of a good time is going in their family camp and getting in their blind and putting camo on with their rifles and deer urine, sitting next to a couple whose good idea or idea of a good time, thank you, Justin. Right next to them is a couple who's like, we're going to the symphony and going to have a nice dinner and we're going to go home and read poetry and put our sleep number on 40. You know, like, you need those people together. That should be the church. I really believe in so many ways it is our church. That's a beautiful thing. There should be rich relationships and friendships where the church doesn't factionalize in the same way that the culture does. There should be friendship and collaboration inside of the church that the culture looks at and says, I can't find that anywhere else. I can't even find it in my own family. We can't get through one Thanksgiving without us wanting to rip each other's heads off. And here's all these people that are together and on the same page and they love each other. Yes, we step on each other's toes. Yes, we offend each other. Yes, we have to forgive each other. Yes, we annoy the fire out of each other sometimes. We have to tolerate each other. But we love each other and there's still friendship and there's still camaraderie and there's still relationship inside of the church. That should be a sharp contrast to our culture. There should also be teamwork. You know, ministering is not something that you do by yourself. It's not solo work. We do link arms, not only with each other, but also with other Christians outside of our church for the mission of Jesus. If you read through the New Testament, you come to the impression very quickly that the churches are collaborating in many ways. You would find the Church of Jerusalem sending representatives and missionaries kind of down to Antioch. You would find the Church of Macedonia taking up a collection and giving to the Church of Jerusalem. You would find the Church of Philippi is giving money to Paul, even though his ministry is no longer in their town, but supporting him as he goes to other people. You'd find the church at Colossae sending representatives and gifts to Paul while he's in prison. And you find even confrontation where Paul is confronting Peter. And like, Peter, you're acting like a racist right now, man. You're not willing to eat with him. What's your problem? And then Peter is saying, Paul, I mean, that guy's hard to understand sometimes. Like, I wish he would just simplify some of his writings a bit. And you find all of this back and forth and this crosstalk and cooperation and mutual support happening. You find a lot of teamwork. Yes, it's messy sometimes. It's not always clean and easy, but they cooperate and they work together. And there should be amongst Christendom in general a sense of we are on the same team, we are in the same family, not a denominational or theological tribalism that possesses a lot of Christians and a lot of churches. Now, let me thread the needle very carefully because some of you have little red flags that are popping up and you think that I'm about to say that we should all get coexist bumper stickers and just have an ecumenical sing-along, which I'm not arguing for. But I am arguing for us understanding that if someone is going to worship Jesus in heaven with us one day, we're on the same team. We may have a lot of charitable disagreements with them, but we're on the same team. Let me see if I can use a metaphor to explain this. This is a picture of North America, and it shows national borders. National borders are important. That's something else that our politics, I guess, have taught us recently. It's quite the topic of conversation. But national borders are important. You need to know where this country ends and the other country begins. And you can't trifle with those things. Canada can't bring some tank across our border and that go well, right? That's an act of violence towards our country. We're going to fight about that. You can't just fly your aircraft into our airspace. This is our country, right? You can't just come across the border however you want without any documentation. We have a citizenship. We have something that exists here. Those national borders are important. Oftentimes, pastors have used this as maybe a metaphor for what would kind of box in Christianity. There are borders to Christendom. We are not suggesting, nor does Jesus ever suggest, that everyone's going to heaven and we're all the children of God and we're all just going to worship together one day, no matter what. That's not what the scriptures teach. There are national borders. There is a border between Christians and Hindus, and Christians and Muslims, and Christians and Mormons, even if they want to pretend like they're Christians. To be clear and honest, because as much as I'd love to sidestep this, I wouldn't be doing my job if I did, because I know that roughly half of our church has a Catholic upbringing, and lots of people have spun their wheels and tried to figure out, is there a national border between Catholicism and evangelicalism or other churches? The Catholics would certainly say yes. If you've ever been a part of the Catholic Church and wanted to go to a different church, you know what I'm talking about. But they would say, nope, that is a border, and like, you can't go to heaven if you're not part of the Catholic Church. We would not say you can't go to heaven based off of the church you attend, but we would say, even inside of Catholicism, there are major doctrinal distinctives. There's a lot of secondary ones, but there's a couple doctrinal distinctives that are very primary, very important, namely how we come to faith in Jesus and how we would have right standing with God. That the majority of Catholics are under the impression that it's based off of their works and off of their effort. And we would say that's so anti-gospel, it's not even funny. If you get that wrong, you got it all wrong. Like, it is not because of your effort, it's because of what Jesus did for us and the grace of God that we are allowed entrance into heaven and right standing with God. And that is a doctrine that's distinct enough and primary enough where it can create a national border, and it should, rightly so. But in our country, we have, new picture, state borders. The national borders would be primary doctrines. The divinity of Jesus, the Trinity, salvation by grace through faith, you know, big, important things. But then you have these divisions in our country that are important. Pennsylvania being separate from West Virginia is important. We need to know where maybe the militias reside or who's responsible to fix that road, because where does it lie? But we don't require you to go through customs, you know, to go to West Virginia. We perhaps would consider the opposite and make them go through customs to come here, but probably not. Those distinguish a state, and you could think of state borders almost as denominational borders. Is Pennsylvania and California, are we going to collaborate left and right? Probably not, but we're not against them. Sure, there's ideologies we may oppose. We may roll our eyes at certain things, but we are the United States of America, right? We are distinct, we are separate in a way, but we're still in the same country. We're still on the same team enough where we're not trying to be tribal and say, well, Texas is what's wrong with our country, or California is what's wrong with our country, and we hate that state as much as I joke about West Virginia. You know, we're supposed to get along. We're the United States. That makes sense? It doesn't mean that we're in cahoots left and right and we do everything together, but it does mean we're on the same team. And I fear that there are a lot of Christians who just don't understand this basic premise, that they think either my church has to be best friends with every denomination and every person who disagrees with me on some secondary issues that aren't trivial, but they're not primary. They may disagree on the sequence of end times events, or they may disagree on Bible translations and versions, or they may disagree on how exactly to worship and their worship style or spiritual gifts or a whole number of things. And we can disagree, we can even be distinct in many ways, but still understand I'm not tribalistic towards you. I'm not building a wall and throwing a grenade over it at you. I'm not going to start to just be ultra suspicious or flippantly throw out that you're a heretic or attack you. We are not supposed to be Christians who attack our own and kill off our wounded, but instead there should be some sense of cohesion and unity and teamwork that would possess all of the people of God. Does that make sense? I bring this to your attention largely because today is our mission trip Sunday. You may have noticed in your bulletin, there's a little handout today. And at the end of the service, Pastor Dom will walk you through this. But this is a component of our missions program, which if you're new to church, every October we have a missions month and we highlight all that God has done through our missions program through the year, and we look to the future of what we believe God wants us to do, and we even encourage people to step up and to be generous. And I'm pleased to report we are exceeding our goal for this year. We had a goal that was around $315,000 to give away to other ministries and other missionaries and other projects outside of our church. And we're on pace closer to 350, truthfully. And you guys have just been awesome and so responsive and so beautiful in that. But the heartbeat of our missions program is first, let us get the gospel all the way around the world. But second, let's find some other ministries and some other people who we can cooperate with and we can have teamwork with. And I'm going to tell you the truth. Out of 100 and something, you know, ministries and missionaries that we give money to on a monthly basis, and it's lots of money every month, there's not a single one of them that we dot every theological I the same or we cross every theological T the same. There are a whole host of secondary issues that we would disagree with some of them on, but that's okay. We can support them, we can love them, we can see them go reach people for Jesus, and they're not our enemies. We're on the same team. We can support and do our best to put wind in their sails, and I would encourage you to perhaps, as Dom walks through this today, sign up for one of these, get some information, consider going on one of these trips, consider partnering with them. It'd be a beautiful thing to have teamwork. This should be the case inside of the church where there's not these groups that factionalize and don't work together. And let me be quick to say, don't take what your little tribe is in the church and be tribal even here inside. It is possible for a group who does maybe a Bible study and group together on a weekly basis to become so close-knit that you are no longer a close-knit tribe, but you're a clique. And you won't welcome anyone else in. You don't want a new face, you don't want new blood, you don't want anyone else, and you're gonna sit with those people and you're gonna talk to those people and you're going to exclude everyone else. Don't do that. Don't do I serve on the nursery team and we need more of the church's budget, so we're against the other part of kids' ministry because they take up the majority of the budget. Or no, I'm on the youth team, we need the budget. Stuff like that happens in churches where people that are supposed to get along start to fight over things and become very tribal. That's not in the church, but that's also outside of the church. Our relationship with just Christendom in general, there should be a heartbeat of, if you are on Team Jesus, then I am fundamentally on Team Jesus with you. And we don't have to do everything together, but I can love you, I can support you, and we can work together in a number of instances. That makes sense? So there's relationship. There is teamwork, but there's also hospitality. And I purposely put a period in the middle of the word. I know it's not supposed to be there. To indicate that the church is both a hospital and hospitable, both. There's a hospital for sinners and there is hospitality for seekers. We are in Luke. That's where I had you turn quite some time ago. Chapter 19. Look at one of the mission statements of Jesus' life. There are a number of these in the Gospels. They all communicate the same basic idea. Luke 19, verse number 10. The Son of Man, Jesus, is come to seek and to save that which is lost. What was Jesus on about? He was after broken and lost people. He wanted to find them and he wanted to bring salvation to them. What is the church on about as followers of Jesus? There's lots of things that we're on about. Lots of ways to answer that question. But we are primarily about finding people that don't know Jesus, who are lost, who are broken, and seeing Jesus save them. That's what we're about. The church is never meant to be this place that is a country club for saints, where you build four walls and you say, do you look like me? Do you talk like me? Do you act like me? Do you think like me? Well, then welcome. And if not, go pound salt. Get out of here. That's not the church. The church is on mission to go find people that need Jesus and introduce them to Jesus so that they can find the salvation that is in Jesus. The church is meant to be a hospital for sinners, where people can come and they can take all of their issues. I mean, you think about our community and all the people that now have descriptors on their life that they never thought in a million years would describe their life. Divorced, broke, addicted, fired. There are people that need help. And the church is meant to be that hospital for sinners. But notice, if you would, not just a hospital for sinners, but hospitality for seekers. Go back a couple pages to Luke chapter number 7. Luke 19 gives us a statement of purpose. Why did Jesus come? Jesus came to seek and to save that which is lost. Jesus came to give his life a ransom for many. Jesus came for those people. But how did Jesus come? Luke 7 is a statement of method. It's not purpose, it's method. How did he do it? How did he go find those sinners and then offer them salvation? Well, let's look at it. Verse 33 of Luke 7, John the Baptist came neither eating nor drinking wine, and you say he has a devil. John the Baptist was not about mealtime, you know? But, verse 34, the Son of Man has come. It doesn't give you the statement of purpose, come to seek and to save that which is lost. It gives you a statement of method. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking. And you say, behold, a gluttonous man, a wine bibber, a friend of publicans and sinners, which is meant to be an accusation on their end, but is one of the most beautiful things you'll ever read about the Lord Jesus. How did Jesus come? Did he come with an army of angels? No. Did he come in glory? No. Did he come on the clouds of heaven? No. How did he come? With a dinner bell in his hand. He came eating and drinking. There's a theologian who concludes that in Luke's gospel, Jesus is either going to a meal, at a meal, or coming from a meal the entire gospel. Those of you that like mealtime and you like food, Luke's gospel is for you. Luke 5, Jesus eats with tax collectors and sinners at the home of Levi. Luke 7, he's anointed at the home of Simon the Pharisee during a meal. Luke 9, he feeds the 5,000. Luke 10, he eats in the home of Mary and Martha. Luke 11, Jesus condemns the Pharisees and teachers of the law at a meal. Luke 14, Jesus is at a meal when he urges people to invite the poor to their meals rather than their friends. Luke 19, Jesus invites himself to dinner at Zacchaeus' house. Socially inappropriate, but he did it nevertheless. Luke 22, we have the account of the Last Supper. Luke 24, the risen Christ has a meal with two disciples in Emmaus, and then later eats fish with disciples at Jerusalem. It's meals all over the place. All over the place, Jesus is eating. Like, what's his strategy for reaching the world? Dinner time, baby. How beautiful is that? Like, remember the story of Zacchaeus? Where there's this publican, the social outcast. I mean, a publican in that day is like a Ku Klux Klan member or a pedophile or a terrorist. It's like someone you do not mingle with at all. And there he is, Zacchaeus, get on down here. And he comes down, Zacchaeus, we're gonna have a meal together, buddy. Not in my place, because I'm like homeless, but I hear you oppressed the poor and got a wicked pad like on the edge of town. Let's go over there. Let's get in that pantry, buddy, you know? And they go and they have a meal, and Zacchaeus' life is changed through a meal. I give all this to you this morning for two reasons. Number one, I want there to be a proper paradigm. The church is not supposed to be this place where tribalism runs rampant, even if it runs rampant in our culture, even if it runs rampant in your own family, which I would encourage you to be a peacemaker and try to put an end to that. So there's a paradigm that we should have, but there's also a practice that we should have. We should have a practice of hospitality, of reaching out to people, of welcoming people, of eating with them. If you look at the ministry of Jesus, it's very gracious. And someone has accurately said that grace does not ask for an application. Grace extends an invitation. Jesus is constantly extending invitations to all sorts of people. And I want to encourage you to do the same. I actually want to challenge you in the month of April to perhaps go out of your comfort zone and be hospitable to someone you normally would not be. Whether it be the extended family that you haven't seen in 2 years, but they live 10 minutes down the road from you. Whether it be your neighbors who have invited you over for the barbecue or the birthday party, but you're introverted, so you don't go and you never invite them to your place. Whether it be your coworker, someone, a family, someone that you know, open up your home, open up your pantry, open up your wallet. Be hospitable to them. You say, well, I don't have a big place. Okay, take them to a restaurant. Or go to your little place. They probably won't care. I don't know how to cook. I'll give you a secret. J&S makes some mean wedding soup. They got some good pizza. Texas Roadhouse has some rolls and cinnamon butter for $5, people, okay? Can I get a witness? You don't got to cook. Go get their food. Bring it in. Like, stop with the excuses. Find someone and reach out to them. Find someone within the church, in your group, someone you sit next to, someone who's a complete stranger. You say, someone I just meet in the lobby at church, I'm going to invite them to come on over and have a meal. Sure, why not? Go be hospitable. Practice hospitality. Practice dinner time. It's beautiful and it's straightforward. I think sometimes we make evangelism so complicated. We convince everyone that only the type A extroverted people can do it, or the people that know everything about theology. Listen, just go have a meal. And you don't even have to work the meal like around Jesus. Like, it'll probably just come up if he's part of your life. I dare you to purposely have a meal with someone who you know is not like you. They're like two generations above you or below you. You know they voted differently than you in the last election. A meal with them? Yeah, with them. Go sit down. You don't even have to talk politics if you don't want, but just be hospitable to people. Tribalism builds walls. The gospel builds bridges. It builds bridges for a purpose, for the mission in the name of Jesus, but it builds bridges. Let me encourage you, if you want to do this and you want to be hospitable, please don't make it awkward. You say, what do you mean? I'm socially awkward as it is. I mean, just avoid the overtly awkward stuff, okay? Do not invite them over for a meal and then let your nephew come over and do a Cutco knife presentation, all right? Can we agree that bait and switch is not good? Do not pull out your flannel graph and try to teach them Genesis to Revelation at dinner, okay? Just go be with people. Reach out. If you're not careful, you will do life and talk to and be in group with and go to church with and have your kids in the school and the sports teams with people that are just like you. And you'll never spend any time reaching out to sinners who need a savior or seekers who have questions. So reach out. Take a page from the book of Jesus. And may the church in an age of tribalism be a place for collaboration. What do you mean by that? Well, I mean relationship. I mean teamwork. I mean hospitality.